I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast.
And so you can just say, so I don't mess it up. I just feel like I'll totally mess up your name. But how about if you just introduce yourself, say what you do, and talk about the book a little bit, like the main reason you wrote the book, if you don't mind.
Okay, yeah, let's see if I can do that. My name is Alessandra Pigni. I'm a humanitarian psychologist and a writer, which is the thing that I love the most. Why I wrote this book, The Idealist Survival Kit. I guess it all starts from my experience as a humanitarian professional. I started to work with an organization called Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, in 2008. And I worked first in the Middle East, in Israel and Palestine, which is an area of, you know, political conflict. And after that, I went to work with the same organization in China, in the area of Sichuan, after a massive earthquake. So that was like post-disaster. And I really loved the work that I was doing, especially, you know, I kind of fell in love with the Middle East at the time. And one of the things that I observed during my work was that we as humanitarian aid workers, we were providing all sorts of services and support to the local population. And often we also were in a bad shape. We were the ones also who needed some kind of support. On one hand, in order to do our work like better, but on the other hand, also just kind of like to make it through the day. And for me, I was very lucky because I had the possibility, as a psychologist, I was entitled to supervision. So I had a space at least once a month, but really more often if needed, to sit with a psychologist who was like a senior psychologist and just talk about what was going on and not just around, you know, the people that I was myself counseling, but also, you know, anything that was going on for me in my work. And that was a great space, you know, for me to have. And I remember then having conversations with some colleagues and someone telling me, actually, what we would all need that sort of supervision, that sort of, like, support when needed, but we, you know, because we're not psychologists, we're not into it, and that really made me think, you know, because I thought, actually, you know, it's kind of common sense that if you're doing this kind of work, you know, you're far from home, and you're often in a quite like difficult political context, or maybe it's like post disaster. That you know, as a human being, we all need some kind of support and space, and just space to process what is going on. But what struck me at the time was also the fact that often I would talk to people, and including myself, and some of the problems that we were experiencing were kind of coming from within the organization. So one would think, you know, that you go to a war zone, and what is really affecting you is the political context. And that can be true as well, of course, you know, because, you know, people run the risk of being kidnapped, or, you know, like it can be very unsettling if you work, you know, under bombs, really, let's face it. It's not easy. But the day-to-day life within a humanitarian organization, it's just, you know, pretty much like working in any other organization. You know, people work behind the computer often, you know, the idea that the media portray of people doing humanitarian work is it's really not what it is. You know, often people work in an office and they work behind the computer, and, you know, and they do budgets and they do, you know, like yearly plans and all of that. So I started to reflect on how what was going on within the organizations was affecting people, because I wasn't seeing so much trauma. I was seeing much more burnout. And so the causes are different, you know, like people will burn out not only if they work too much, but only if, also if they are immersed in a kind of work environment that it's not, to put it mildly, very friendly, and that it's a kind of maybe toxic work environment where, you know, people feel that they're not appreciated, where there is harassment as well, bullying. You know, I heard stories of people being sort of like sexually harassed and then having to kind of, like, they felt that they couldn't really speak out and there wasn't any kind of mechanism of support. And it's a sort of work that, you know, like if you're doing humanitarian work and, or if you, any job where you're kind of helping other, you just have to kind of put up with anything because, you know, people you're helping have it worse. So there's that kind of mentality, you know. So, you know, it's not your place to complain because you're not a refugee. It's not your place to complain because, you know, you're healthy. Look at other people, you know, they have illnesses. And it's kind of like, I mean, it's like comparing apples and pears. It makes no sense, you know. I start to write about all of this in my blog, which is called mindfulnext.org. It's kind of playing on the word of mindfulness because I was, you know, kind of been practicing mindfulness for many years and bringing the approach into my work. But I wanted to bring it with a kind of with a twist, something that was a bit more out there rather than just about me. Rather than just sort of like my nice, cozy meditation practice, but rather something that I would just bring in my daily life, with in my relations, in my works, in my day-to-day situations that I would face.
Are you in the United States right now?
No, I'm in Bethlehem, in Palestine.
Oh my, that's great. This is wonderful.
Yes. Yes, so I'm in the West Bank, whatever you want to call it. This place is like, it's like, it has a list of names because nobody can agree on what it is. So it's like, it's the Holy Land, it's the West Bank, it's Palestine, it's the Palestinian territories. You pick your you know,
depending on who you're talking to, probably it'll
switch. Yeah, exactly, you know. So it's one of those like kind of controversial places for people, so depending on where people stand politically, that's how they would kind of call this place. But anyway, this is, you know, it's an Arab town. It's Bethlehem. It's a small, nice, quite nice old town. And I'll be here for about a month now. I came for some work and then I you know, I came back again. You know, I've been kind of doing quite a bit of work on and off in this part of the world. So, and I think if you've read my book, you can see that there's like I refer to Israel and Palestine a number of times. So,
and your home base is in Italy, though?
My home base is in Oxford in the UK.
Okay, yeah.
Yes.
I noticed that's what it said in the in your introduction, that
yeah.
that's where you have that. But I wasn't sure if that's kind of your main place where you're living most of the time. Or
yeah, that's my base, definitely.
I'm sure this survival guide was sort of written in a sense for yourself and also for all your colleagues. And what drew me to want to bring it to more people in my audience isn't because I think I have a lot of humanitarians listening. I think that it plays into what I really enjoy doing, is helping people lift their spirits and be encouraged. But there's a lot of people who are growing weary in sort of social justice issues, resistance mm-hmm. issues, equality issues, and you know, become easily discouraged when there's an onslaught of so many things that seem impossible,
yeah.
and day after day sort of fighting to change, you know, find change in the world. And I think I love your book. It's just a gem. I love it.
Thank you so much. That's yeah, really kind.
I thought it would be, you know, seeing the 75 Simple Ways, I'm like, oh, a tip book. That's nice. And then I read it and it's more like, it feels devotional. I don't know do you know what I mean?
Actually, thanks very much. I mean, this is like, I think the person who wrote the introduction, the foreword, he really nailed that as well, you know, because he writes, he says at some point, this is a book of meditation or a book of contemplation, actually, something like that.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that is what, I'm not sure that's what I wanted, but that's mm-hmm. What is close to me in a way, you mm-hmm. know. I didn't want just like to give people some advice and some kind of self-help tips, and then they could just use them and then it didn't work because it doesn't work. Like,
right. Yeah, it's more rooted and it's more touching deeper places than here's some things that I did and here's some things people told me and here's something that could help you. It's actually kind of, to me anyway, striking at a much deeper interior things and richer things that you could read this and feel better even before you did anything. You know what I'm saying? Which is that it's devotional in the sense that it's also reading it is also in its own medicine too. So I felt like, congratulations. Yeah, it's really a beautiful work. And I knew it would be good anyway. The topic is something that is like, I love reading things like this because I get encouraged by it, but it was particularly beautifully written. And so I'll get all excited about when I find things like this, and I was going to be excited to talk to you anyway, but now I'm like, I'm more like a little jumping up and down, like, okay, get this book, come on, for my listeners, because it's great to read things that will speak to people's hearts and actually, I think, make a difference when they have lost their spirit or are, you know, heading toward burnout. Is a really despairing place to be.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the idea, in fact, it's that it's a book that it's not just for, you know, people who do humanitarian work or mm-hmm. kind of like social change work. I mean, I come from that place, so I bring those experiences and stories into the book. But it's a book that could equally be useful for people who are, I don't know, they're teachers, doctors, nurses, doing any kind of other sort of like work where you are in sort of serving others, helping others, engaged in something that it's kind of bigger than me. And this is something that other people who read the book said about it, that it's, you know, yes, I come from that place of humanitarian work, but really this is a book for society who could experience burnout, because we have this kind of crazy way of working. Mm-hmm. We are all at risk of burnout. You know, we're working for organizations that you know, they just want us to be productive and effective and all of that, and forget that, especially I'm thinking, you know, like organizations that have some kind of mission and some kind of, in theory, some kind of vision and some they're founded on some ideals. And at some point, all of that gets lost because, you know, we have to be very productive and we have to be efficient. And that's all very well, but not if we lose our humanity. Mm. And I think this is what was very important for me, to bring that kind of reflection, and then for people to do what they wish with. It's very important that we don't have that sort of mismatch between what we say we are all about, what we say we believe in, what we say we do, and what we actually and how we actually carry ourselves on a kind of daily basis in our communities or organizations. Because it's all very nice to talk about, you know, empowerment and sustainability and justice, but then where are those values within the walls of our organizations? Where are they? I've seen, I have seen that mismatch, and that's where the reflection came, my reflections came from, you know, like, I think for me, it's not about sort of like building the perfect organization or the perfect work environment, because that's not realistic. That's wishful thinking, and that is probably, you know, the best way to kind of be very disappointed if you think that you can build the perfect environment where you will be happy and nobody will ever hurt your feelings and that. But I guess it's more about being aware of the fact that certain ideas, ideals, and values that we hold dear are something that we might as well want to start practicing them in our own work environment with our colleagues. In a way, it shapes also the work that then we do in the world. And I have seen brilliant organizations like really paying attention to all of this, and the quality of what they bring to their communities, it's completely different, you know, because it starts from a place of kind of awareness and care and learning and reflecting and learning from mistakes and just being more open rather than saying, you know, well, you know, this is the way we do things and we don't really have time for these kind of soft things, soft skills, you know, which is ridiculous. They're not soft skills at all.
Mm. Yeah, it's sort of the difference between treating humanitarian work as sort of with just the business model without the human element and forgetting that humans are doing it, but humans are recipients of the service as well.
Yeah, and I think this is true really across other sectors. You know, like if we look at education, we look at schools, we look at hospitals. Again, if we apply the sort of business model, it doesn't really work because if you're working with human beings, you have to take into account, and we all are, you know, even if you're like sitting behind the computer and answering the phone, in the end, you are working with human beings, and that quality of care and attention for oneself and for the others does really makes a difference. Doctors, you know, if you they will see you, you need an operation, they will do it, but it's also the how. And it's the same for teachers, and it's the same for humanitarian workers. And so that's why I think this kind of reflections that I have in my book, they apply to, you know, across the board in a way. You know, they're not just just something that are valid for aid workers, but for anyone who's like in a serving profession, because anyone who's gone into a kind of profession with some kind of ideals. You know, I never believed that somebody becomes a teacher or a doctor or a humanitarian worker just because they think that they will get lots of money.
Right, of course.
But, you know, mm-hmm. there's something else as well. Yes. And if that maybe it gets lost in the way, but it's there. So I think it's also about rediscovering that. And I guess for organizations, whatever they are, you know, or humanitarian or social change or, you know, any kind of other organizations that have some social purpose in a way, then realizing that burnout is a problem of not only of how much we work, which is sometimes, you know, it's too much definitely in our society, but it's how we work. Mm-hmm. And the kind of work environment that we create and the kind of, you know, care and attention and listening attitude and all of that that we bring, and openness, really.
Well, let me ask you something. Let me ask you something about burnout. You talk in your book that it has to do with losing your spirit. Maybe you can a little bit encapsulate what kind of people suffer burnout? Like, what was actually going on when that happens?
Yes. So one of the things that's sort of one of the kind of common, traits of people who suffer from burnout, in what I have seen and people I've interviewed, is that, you know, people go into a particular kind of work with an idea of how it should look and with ideals, you know, like of wanting to make a difference, wanting to bring some kind of change into the world, into their community. And there is what unfortunately often happens is a gap between those ideals and the reality of what goes on inside an organization. I hear this from, you know, people I work with who are not aid workers as well, like teachers. And I keep bringing in these other professions because it's very relevant for teachers, for doctors. I mean, it's like burnout is huge. And so it's like stepping into an organization with the idea that you're going to make a difference for people's life, that you're going to heal, if not the world, at least the people that you're working with. And then actually reality hits and people find themselves, you know, trapped in organizations where there is a huge amount of bureaucracy, where, you know, kind of thinking is not allowed. It's like, you know, we have, you know, protocols that we need to follow, and it's all kind of like follow the rules, and people work very long hours and they don't see their work being appreciated. I mean, I'm giving you the kind of worst case scenario. Of course, there are many organizations, and I have seen them, where this is not what happens. And in fact, people are not burnt out. They may be very tired because they work long hours, and they maybe even reach a point of kind of saying, you know, I really feel exhausted. But what happens then, if you ask them, are you happy about your job? Are you happy about your organization? They will say, yes, but I need to have a break. And then they go on, they take a break, they come back regenerated, and they're happy to step into the same job and same organization and carry on. Maybe they're able to adjust a few things so that they will not reach a point of exhaustion again. Whereas if you burn out, often the way to heal is get out of that job, get out of that work environment, because a break, like a holiday, it's not going to fix anything. And I think this is, you know, because people, when people burn out, they become quite cynical. This is also, you know, one of the things that that I've observed, that people are also, they become kind of somehow tough and cynical with the people that they're meant to serve.
Oh, yeah, there's like a hardened shell.
Yeah, and a kind of loss of empathy for the other, and loss of compassion, and almost kind of blaming them. And all of this is because at the end of the day, you're not satisfied with what is going on in your work, in your organization. So it's kind of like lots of, I guess, disappointments piling up, and then people end up feeling burnt out.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it does sound like an exhaustion that goes all the way to like the core of yourself.
Yeah.
And you wind up trying to protect yourself from that. And so it ends up, you know, being completely counterproductive. Well, the other thing you mentioned in your book, I was noticing this was really interesting. Sometimes people who are drawn into such demanding work won't really go in with sort of the inner equipment, in a sense, to deal with that. It's sort of they won't necessarily be prepared to have sort of the interior strength to handle it, in a sense. So they maybe, like, people in leadership might not be sort of emotionally mature or have some of those traits that would be really helpful to have when you're serving people, or something like a unreflective kind of way of being.
Well, this is again something that I guess organizations maybe need to think about, and how they can prepare their staff and volunteers better for the job, not just with the technical skills, but with the emotional intelligence that is needed to do certain kinds of jobs, certain kinds of jobs. I mean, I guess if you ask me, is a person who is like, maybe, you know, I've seen managers who were really not emotionally capable to do their job, but they would be able to get funding, for example, for the organization. And so people would put up with them because, you know, oh yeah, no, that person is very, you know, they got us like funding, so we need to hold on to him or her. So in one sense, I'm not even saying that people who are not emotionally capable cannot somehow deliver good results, but I think in the long run, if that poisons the environment and pushes other people out of the organization, or puts them in a situation where if they don't have a choice to go elsewhere, they have a miserable life, then I don't know if it's really worth it. I think what we need to aim is to find people who have the sort of professional technical skills for a job, but also the emotional intelligence, and invite them to develop that side of emotional intelligence and mindfulness, and kind of integrate it within the culture of the organization, within the everyday lived experience of the organization, which is different from just saying, oh, well, you know, but we are providing some kind of staff care, you know, we give some, you know, stress management training, or even we allow people to go on an 8-week mindfulness training. Yes, but if that is kind of an isolated thing that becomes like my own little self-care, which has nothing to do with, you know, the organizational system, the place I work in, it's not built. built into the spirit and into the culture of the organization. I mean, it's pretty useless, to be honest. So where I have seen that it really makes a difference is where you have leaders who, you know, they may not be managers, often they are, but, you know, they're just, you know, like leaders in the organization who, you know, kind of bring a different attitude and a different culture, different spirit to the everyday life of the organization. And that makes a difference. It makes a difference for people who work there, and it makes a difference for people who access the services. I've just worked with a really great social change organization. They work with women, and they have a kind of amazing work environment. They work a lot, but nobody was burned out. And they kind of generate I almost felt they generate love within the organization and with the community they work with, and they're very successful in what they do. They you know, because, you know, like for instance, the city council in their town realized that the work that they do with women is so good that they gave them like the possibility to use a whole building for free for I don't know how many years. And this is because they've built a reputation for being like a great organization, for a great organization to work for and a great organization to work with, to be helped by. These kind of things go together. You know, if it's a great organization to go to work for, often what they are doing vis-a-vis the community is also great.
Mm. Well, do you think that that's built in from the beginning with how they're connecting with people within the organization and then how they're connecting with people who they serve? It's just kind of baked in?
What do you mean?
From the ground up with the organization, do you sense that their values are ones that are very connectional with each other and supportive, and then that out of that overflow that goes into the people that they're serving?
Yeah. I mean, it's about leaving out the values or doing our best to leave out the values that we kind of hold dear, rather than having them on paper and then not really kind of practicing. And I guess, you know, like maybe it sounds a bit harsh to say, you know, we need to practice what we preach. I think that's maybe sounds a bit preaching itself, and I don't like I don't like that, because kind of this is the thing. I mean, we all, you know, we all have a bad day, we all make mistakes, we all we've all been like the difficult colleague. But I think it's about owning that kind of, and within an organization, which can be also like, I say an organization, but it can be like a community, a group of people that work together, that they're doing something together, you know, wherever you have kind of group dynamics, I would say, you know, like shit happens, you know, so. But I guess, you know, it's kind of acknowledging all of that and putting aside the time and the space to be open about that, and rather than kind of sort of sweeping it under the carpet or thinking that it's not important, being able to set some kind of healthy boundaries, and being able to say yes and no when we mean it, rather than kind of trying to be available all the times, trying to kind of be and available, or I mean trying to be available all the times, I mean also like on social media, or you know, like at work or with our families or whatever, you know, but just like being able to say, well, this doesn't interest me, and that's it, you know, I'm not well, you know, I can live with like the fear of missing out for, you know, a few days, and then I'm not going to miss it, to be honest. That's what makes the difference between, you know, an organization that where you actually want to be, you know, an organization you want to engage with, and an organization you kind of, you know, you kind of want to run away from. And then it's also like having those, it's for me, it's, you know, burnout prevention, it's a lot, it's about like day-to-day life, the informal moments of support, appreciation, feedback as well, you know, I can, which, you know, sometimes needs to be constructive, in terms of like, you know, you need to tell like someone you work with that things are not really going great. But, you know, having also like those difficult conversations, but, you know, having them in a way that it's constructive. And all of this, it's so difficult. And it's even more difficult if we are not in any way encouraged and taught how to do it.
Mm. Right. Well, if everybody is afraid to criticize or be criticized because it doesn't seem, it seems threatening instead of loving, or for some positive reason, then no one's going to say a word, and things won't really be noticed and improved on.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, it's two big things for me that are part of the burnout prevention and sort of thriving in a workplace, and it's about doing something that is meaningful, you know, which is the core of burnout prevention, and doing it in a workplace that is nurturing and caring and learning, where, you know, like you're kind of invited to bring your best selves, rather than to bring your cynical, disappointed self. That's and if we have those days where, you know, we're disappointed and a bit cynical and critical, then that there can be a space to process that, rather than to deny it. And I guess, you know, it sounds like maybe that I'm sort of talking about the ideal organization, but I have seen organizations that are like that, and they're not necessarily super wealthy organizations that have like millions of dollars that they can sort of spend on staff care and pamper their staff. I mean, I'm talking about organizations that work in places like the Gaza Strip, which is one of the most difficult places in the world. And nevertheless, because they have such amazing leadership, they're able to create work environments where people thrive in spite of what is going on in the political context.
What are some of the qualities, or just the qualities, but what are some of the patterns you notice with some of these smaller organizations that you would be able to pick out similarities or actions or something that they do that seems to be a common thread?
Well, for example, having informal time together as a team, like informal time where they share a meal together, but not just as a one-off every 6 months, but sort of as a kind of ritual, as a thing that happens regularly. You know, I've seen some places where, you know, people have lunch together, you know, which sounds completely revolutionary now, because people have their sandwich in front of the computer alone. So not only they eat alone, they also eat something that's completely unhealthy. So, this is one thing. And this is something that I've heard like over and over from people, how much they appreciated the fact that there were these kind of like shared meals. Because, you know, like, I think it's also like quite symbolic, you know, like a meal is something that you, where you, you're nurturing yourself. So there's like nurturing the physical, but also, I guess, nurturing more like the emotional and the relational side. Because then, and also, you know, how important it is. I was just talking about this with a friend of mine recently, and you know, she works in a completely different sector, you know, like more like in the art scene. But sort of like top CEO kind of thing. And she was telling me how it was one of her colleagues who now retired, who would pop out to the market every day, buy food, come back, cook for everyone, and they would have a meal together. And now he retired, and that was very, very sad because they didn't do it anymore. And she was saying, you know, like, it would be impossible to justify this kind of behavior if, you know, like with donors, for example, because they would say, what, somebody's popping out to buy food during work hour and then they come back and they cook and all of this, you know, they take an hour every day to do this. This is not acceptable. You know, what are we paying for? But the reality, my friend was saying, as I said, as a CEO, she was like, those meals together were really very productive in a way, because we would meet each other in a different way, and, you know, and have conversations about things that were important for work. But instead of meeting in a, you know, like in a formal meeting, we would have it over lunch, and the quality of the conversation was completely different and very productive. So I think this is just an example that, and I'm bringing this example because so many people have told me about the importance, how much they appreciated having this kind of shared meals on a regular basis, and how much they enjoyed it. And then, you know, the other thing is, you know, just giving people appreciation, and I'm not talking about, you know, like every 6 months, you know, there's like a formal review and then I'm telling you how nice it is that what you're doing, but just on a daily basis, just kind of like appreciating what people are doing and noticing what people are doing. And this doesn't have to come just from, you know, the top down, but it's kind of like, you know, across the organization, you know, within a group, just telling people that you appreciate something that they've done, and kind of being clear about what you appreciate. That's also something that it's very important. But in a way, you know, that what I'm all the things I talk about, even in my book, I think they're just common sense. You know, I think, you know, kind of lost track of like some of the important things that are all about sort of building healthy relations and acknowledging you know, what is not going so well and addressing it. And everything becomes like a policy and a rule, and we kind of like we almost have to go back and teach people to be polite. I mean, yeah. I'm sorry, but you know, this is true. Ridiculous. You know, it's kind of like, just, as I said, just be nice, you know, just be polite, just be respectful, you know.
Well, you know, what you're saying is interesting, but it's like, we say it's common sense, but there is a training to it too, because if you don't practice being, you know, gracious with other people and being appreciative and being courteous, I don't think it does come naturally. Like it's something that you build up like a muscle. I think that there is something to be said of making it part of a culture it has to be practiced and practiced. So it's, even though it might seem like common sense, like it's a good refresher. Like as I'm thinking of it, reading about it, I'm thinking, yeah, but are we forgetting to be kind? Because there's so few kindnesses that are normal that had been, you know, like we got a thank you note from a relative and she said thank you to us and it seemed so extra to get a thank you note. But I was like, oh, that's right. People used to always write thank you notes. I remember getting thank you notes, but it's like a cordialness that's gone, but not just that one, you know, 1,000 others.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, yeah, no, I think that maybe it's definitely something that, you know, needs to be built become part of the culture, become part of the sort of everyday experience, definitely something that needs to be modeled by managers, by, you know, people in leadership positions. But I guess, you know, it also needs to be something that it's spontaneous, because people can tell when, you know, I'm just doing this because actually, rule number 10 says that I have to give you a call and say thank you, or that I have to send you an email and say that I appreciate your work. And then people read that email, kind of go like, oh, come on.
Yeah. You
know? So it has to feel that it's genuine, you know, right. Like I remember also I was talking to a manager who, you know, was kind of like giving me examples of, you know, the sort of support that he himself as a manager appreciated. And he was like, well, yeah, you know, we get these emails from headquarters. They're all like blah, blah, blah. And they're, you know, you can tell that somebody knows that they have to send you an email and ask you, how are you doing in this, you know, during this kind of like difficult time, because, you know, it was a situation where, you know, like this guy was working in a war context. And it's like, yeah, it was very clear that they were just like following protocols. Whereas then he gave me an example of, you know, like other people they'd been working with, who gave them a call, you know, were like really preoccupied about, you know, like how things were, about the situation, you know, this conflict area and what was going on. And basically it was like, well, one situation was like genuine care. The other was like someone just following a protocol. You can totally tell the difference. I mean, I've been in situations like that where I'm like, okay, well, you don't care, but you have to get to pretend that you do. And I don't know if it's like fake it till you make it. I'm not sure. Sometimes they just fake it and they keep faking it. and then people just take their skills somewhere else. This is the reality, you know, because people have choice and if they have a choice, they will just go somewhere else.
Page 182, about days of honey and days of onions. That really sticks with me because it's so, the images there are so interesting. And maybe you can explain a little bit what it's about. And I think that would be a nice way to close us out. And then after that, you can tell people the best places to find you online.
It's pretty short, yeah. The Persian poet Attar. Do you want me to read the title? Days of Honey, Days of Onions. This is a short chapter from my book. The Persian poet Attar of Nishapur records the fable of a powerful king who asks assembled wise men to create a ring that will make him happy when he is sad. After the liberation, the sages hand him a simple ring with the words, "This too shall pass," etched on it. My Arabic teacher taught me a beautiful expression that resembles the Sufi wisdom, "Yom asal, yom basal," meaning one day honey, one day onions. This Middle Eastern teaching describes impermanence, also an essential doctrine in Buddhism, the concept that things are always changing, that bitter days of onion will eventually end, and there will be days of honey, and so on in a seemingly endless cycle. This is not some pie-in-the-sky positive thinking. Yom Asal u Yom Basal is a reflection of the steadfastness and resilience of a people who have endured all kinds of oppression and resistance and are still able to believe that there is more to life than miserable days of onions. We live a life of constant change, moving home frequently, relocating to new countries or to different area in our own country, changing teams, facing illness and death. Relentless ongoing change, relentless ongoing suffering. We're often forced to face the unknown, plunged into sudden traumatic events. Days of onions will pass. Perhaps we all need a ring like the powerful kings. In mine, I would etch the dance of Arabic letters. Yom Asal o Yom Asal. One day honey, one day onions.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really powerful to realize that if your day is one of onions, that a day of honey will come eventually. And
it's actually true. It's actually true, because I think what I can say that there is a lot of me clearly in my book of my own experiences, both professional experiences and personal experiences, and I do keep that in mind. You know, when I have, you know, days that are very difficult, that this too shall pass, and it does. So I look back at situations where I thought, you know, oh my God, this is it. This is not, you know, this is not going to change. And but it does. So I guess keeping that in mind, and not allowing the thought that this is the way it is, and I'm going to be miserable for the rest of my days. Not getting hooked to that thought, but rather, just taking it for what it is, you know, a difficult moment that will pass. And it was, you know, I was studying Arabic, and my teacher, you know, I love this kind of like expressions, and my teacher taught me this one, and I thought it was really beautiful. And you know, you can just see the image, you know, like a day of onions, you know, a day of like tears as well, you know, because onions bring tears as well, and how that will pass, and then there will be better days. And I mean, I'm not, you know, for me, you know, like days of honey or, you know, better days, it's not about, you know, everything is 100% happy and great. And because I really don't buy into that sort of narrative of sort of positive thinking and living happy forever after, because it's not real and it's not true. But to have days where, you know, engage with what you're doing something meaningful, just, or not doing anything and just being, you know, happy with that. They happen, and they happen to, like, even people who are in the most difficult situations. I guess this is what I've learned, you know, like spending so much time in the Middle East is, it's just seeing people that even in the most challenging situations, then they're able to have days where they just carry on with their daily life. Being in Bethlehem in Palestine now, it's always like a place that teaches me a lot. I come here for work, you know, and I go away that I always learn a lot. I guess that's why I keep coming back.
Yeah.
Yes. When I'm back home, I don't have that, you know, kind of the learning experiences are never so intense. Mm-hmm. So, I'm very grateful that Doctors Without Borders gave me a job here many years ago. And then I kept coming back and I kind of made it into almost my second home.
Well, this has been great. Thank you.
Lisa, thank you so much. And I look forward to meeting you in person in February.
Yeah, that's exciting. Me too. If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. I've created an all-access pass, and you can access the access pass for just $1. It unlocks all show note episodes, too. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. I try to send out a message once or twice a month. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.
I'm very grateful that Doctors Without Borders gave me a job here many years ago, and then I kept coming back, and I kind of made it into my almost my second home.
I appreciate that you'd come on. Maybe you can tell everybody some best places to find you online, and your book is full of this wisdom too. So that's not just that's a one of the 74 bits there.
I have, my website is mindfulnext.org, and I'm also on Twitter @mindfulnext, and on LinkedIn.